Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 26th through July 6th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only, some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Welcome back to a very special episode of Smell You Later.
Ooh. That's me being a ghost. Because it's our Halloween episode.
It is our Halloween episode.
Happy Halloween. Ooh. Our ooky, spooky Halloween episode.
Yeah, it's a really good one. And one that right when we were starting this podcast, I was like, well, first we were like, should we do holiday episodes? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We love being festive.
Yes. And then I'm like, oh, for Halloween, I have the perfect idea. And it came to fruition.
Yeah, you can tell this is Sable's idea because it's good.
You can tell it's mine because it's weird and kind of gross. So,
no, I love it. Yes. It's really exciting. I love Halloween.
I love it too.
It's so fun. It's like my second favorite holiday.
It might be my favorite, or maybe Flag Day. I don't know. Oh
my God. What is your favorite Halloween costume that you have had?
Oh my gosh. When I was a kid, this was like the flexiest flex, like the biggest flex in my entire life. And I will never live up to this moment again. When I was a kid, I must have been in third grade. And my mom, okay, so my mom works in fashion adjacent, like garment production. But she
knows. Sable's mom is Vera Wang. Surprise.
Yeah, I was like, it seems misleading to say my mom works in fashion because she doesn't. It's garment production. But she, you know, she can sew like a wizard. She went to FIT. She also paints really well too. But she used to make a lot of my clothes as a kid. And I would roll up to picture day looking like Jackie O in this like tiny little Chanel baby suit. And weirdly, all of my teachers thought I was rich because they thought it was like designer children's clothes. Mm-hmm. And then all of my friends made fun of me for being poor because my because my mom made my clothes. And for whatever reason, that means I'm poor. Children are fucked. But for Halloween, I was obsessed with Lisa Frank.
Same.
So she made me the bunny ballerina costume. Like full replica. It was like cosplay.
Oh my God.
And when I rolled up to the goddamn playground as the bunny ballerina from Lisa Frank, it was like I was a celebrity rolling up to what is cool in New York, like Dorsia. It's not a real restaurant, but you know, it was like fanfare.
Do you have photos of this, Sable?
I do.
Oh my God, I have to see these.
Yeah.
We have to post these.
Or, well, my parents definitely do. I'll have to like go to their house and raid a photo album.
Yeah.
But yes, it was, ugh. I just remember feeling so cool because I was like, I have the coolest Halloween costume.
Totally. There's nothing like knowing you have a Halloween costume and just like feeling like that girl. You know what I mean? Oh, I love that.
I was like, eat it, bitches.
Totally. Totally.
Or what are you? A witch original.
Yeah. Nice mummy. Yeah.
Did you have a favorite Halloween costume?
Yeah, all of them. actually, like you, my mom also sews like really, really, really well and has always made a lot of my clothes, especially growing up. No one called me poor, they just called me gay. But yeah, I there's this one that I actually don't remember, but I know happened because there are photos. I was Kermit the Frog, and it's this really cute photo of my mom holding me, and I'm wearing, I don't know, she did it really, she like knocked it out of the park. I have to find this. I won't show any of you, but that was really cool, but I wish I remembered it. She made me a merman when I was like 20, which was very cool. And I was like, Mom, I really want to be a mermaid. And she's like, okay. And I was thinking like, you know, we'd get the material that has the gills, not silkscreen, whatever. And that are shiny. And it would essentially be like a pencil skirt moment and like cut off at the knees and then have, I don't know, a fin or some streamers, whatever. She's like, I got it. Don't worry. That costume went to the ankle and it was like a pencil skirt, but like to the ankle. So I was just like shuffling around the entire night. I was like, this is so unsafe. And she's like, yeah, but it looks good. And I was like, you're right. So that was a really, really good one. I was Robin one year and that was also great. But actually, I didn't dress up last Halloween because I was really new to New York and I just didn't get my shit together in time. And also Halloween kind of happened over two weekends last year.
Yes.
I was like really early and I didn't realize like that was the weekend. I thought I had another week. So I didn't have time. And also my best friends were in town. So that was a whole nother thing. And then like by the next weekend, I was like, I'm not doing this twice. But the week, the Halloween before, I was Helga Pataki from Hey Arnold. And I think that that was maybe my best.
That's a great costume. One.
It was really, it was very good. My mom made the dress and I made the hair, which was essentially a helmet with two huge pigtails that stuck out straight in either direction. It really did look, I mean, it looked how she looked in the cartoon. It was, I, not to pat myself on the back, but it was really good. My friend Brian was like, I always forget how much you step your pussy up each Halloween. And I'm like, I don't know. It's great. So
that's the one holiday to turn out.
Totally. I really want to be this Halloween. I really want to be Rosie from the Jetsons.
Oh, that would have been cute.
It's going to be good.
Yeah, we're locked down for Halloween. So.
I know. It's like, I want to put all this work into the costume, but for what? Like, can
for I'm the not, gram.
For the gram.
For the gram.
As if I looked, why was I even asking that question?
I know. I just remember, like, working in beauty around Halloween, it's just like tutorial after tutorial of like Halloween looks.
What
like,
is it?
Nonstop.
It's the deer look.
Yep.
It's
some sort of cat.
Some sort of cat.
Yep.
It's some sort of like zombie skeleton with fake blood.
Mm-hmm. Vampires, sexy vampires.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
God.
We love it. I mean, more power to you guys.
I know.
I never want to look, I don't ever want to be like a sexy version of anything. I applaud everyone that does. It's just not, I just want to look stupid.
I always
want to wear something on my head. That's like every Halloween, I turn it out with something on my head.
I always want to look scary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like you're not sure if it's a costume or not. That's what I want to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, what did I do last year? New York City Halloween it's on a different level than Halloween in general. I feel it's like an honorary or secondary New Year's Eve.
Yes.
Because there's so much FOMO of things to do, places to go. Like everything's expensive. If you want to go to a club or whatever, the cover charge is insane. Yeah. I don't do that. I don't fuck with that.
Yeah.
And then, there's like the investment in your costume. So it's just... It's a lot.
It's like, no, you're totally right. And it's a lot like New Year's Eve. It's like, I do not, it's like the one night a year that I don't want to go to a bar. And I would so much rather just go to like a house party and like, I'd be able to actually like see the costumes and like have a little bit of room.
Yeah.
I
don't know.
Oh my God. When I was Helga, I bartend because I bartended my entire life and I was wearing the pigtails behind the bar. And I'm telling you, the wingspan of these things is probably altogether 4 feet. So I was like knocking bottles down and we had just gotten a new bar back I kept smacking him in the face with them. It was really bad, but really funny.
Yeah. It's like, put these people in bulky costumes in this tiny amount of space behind a bar.
Exactly. I should have been something slutty that year because like I had no room for, and neither did anyone else, but I looked good and that's all that mattered.
I want to just get like, fucked up looking contacts this year. That's what I'll do.
I've actually never put in contacts. They like
terrify
me.
To when I wore glasses like in college, and then I ran out of health insurance, so I ran out of glasses.
Yeah.
And then I just struggled until my eyes improved.
I feel like they're just gonna like float to the back of my eye and slice it off. That's what happens.
Don't you know that's what happens with contact lenses?
Yeah.
No, they don't. They somehow suction just to your iris because that part sticks out more. Like your eyeball's not perfectly round. It's creepy. Right. It's like a lemon.
They're also, they're different sizes.
Yes.
Because they form on their own, just like your testicles. Well, not yours, but.
We're scientists now. Speaking of science.
Yes.
What do you smell like today, Tynan?
Because this is our Ooky Spooky episode, I smell like a fragrance called Sleeping with Ghosts by Mark Buxton.
Wow. Nailed it.
I'm obsessed with ghosts. Not even like paranormal activity, just like sheep ghosts.
Cartoon
just like
ghosts.
As a concept. Yeah, like sheep ghosts as done by the Peanuts.
Got it.
Anyway, actually, this is, I am learning, now called Dreaming with Ghosts. The name has changed. So somebody got sued. this is lovely. So Sleeping with Ghosts is, to me, like a very... purple fragrance. It's very fruity but not super sweet. It's like half fruity and half earthy. There is marigold and quince at the top, and then in the middle there's peony and leather, and then at the base there's vanilla and vetiver. And I don't know,
nice.
It is, it's very
not spooky but nice.
It's not very spooky. I thought it was gonna be like, you know, smell like a head shop. You know, what's that oil company?
I don't know.
Never mind. anyway, it's lovely. To me, it just smells like wind through the curtains in a dark bedroom. It it's nice. It doesn't smell spooky like a ghost. It smells like a memory like a ghost. Ooh. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's really heady, but it's really approachable and really beautiful. Yeah, I think a lot of the Kintz comes through. I don't know if I'm saying that right. What's I also don't know what that is. It's a fruit.
Okay.
But
I've never eaten that.
I'll have to Google image it. I don't know. So it's a lot of that. And then sandalwood and vetiver, I think, help it out. And then vanilla at the base. It's nice. I don't know. It's sort of linear, so it doesn't evolve on the skin a whole lot, which is fine. It's just really beautiful, and I don't wear it a lot, but it's, to me, it's like a nighttime fragrance, not in like a sexy sensual way, but just in the way that it smells dark.
Ooh.
And yeah, it smells like being in a bedroom where the sun is going down and like you're losing light and everything is like glowing blue.
Ooh.
I don't know. I like exactly. Very
that's what it sounds. That's spooky. What it smells like.
Exactly.
That sound.
Spooky vibes. So Sable, what are you wearing?
I am wearing, speaking of spooky, Byredo Gypsy Water.
This is a Byredo podcast.
And part of me is like, are we allowed to say gypsy water?
Yeah, I think we can't say gypsy anymore.
Okay, so just water.
Yeah.
Byredo G water.
Yeah, G water.
G water. Yeah, I don't know if they're aware of that, but or what the origins is it. But the scent itself is lovely.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard of it for a long time before I actually sniffed it, just because it was one of those, like whenever places like Into the Gloss would do top shelves with models,
yep.
It was always like a model fragrance. So it's like, oh, I know what that smells like. Nothing.
Exactly.
Maybe like a flower. And it does smell like flowers. It's like a woody floral. There's some balsamic notes, which I recently learned is, because I always thought balsamic was like balsamic vinegar, but same. It's like, no, it's from the balsa tree. Duh. So it's this really woody, musky floral scent, which to me, it does smell like models in the sense of like the ITG model, the girl who just wears her boyfriend's trousers and jeans and sweatshirts and somehow they fit her in a flattering way.
Also, you literally are a model. So let's start
not that
there.
Kind of model. I'm a fit model, which is basically like a human mannequin, literally like a human marionette, not as glamorous, but it's a source of income. Although I haven't done it in the past 6 months.
Wait, are you a fit model? I just meant you're yes. hot.
Oh,
oh, oh.
No, I am.
Oh, cool. For what? Yeah. For like,
okay. Well, it's like a little bit of nepotism involved, because it's like the company my mom works for.
Oh.
And I just happen to weirdly be the same proportions of their regular fit model, mm-hmm. just two sizes smaller. So I'm their petite fit model.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, it's so weird. They sell, it's like not cool clothes. It's like stuff I think your recently divorced high school art teacher auntie would wear in South Florida.
I love that there's literally like nothing you don't do. I'm trying to pay you a compliment. You're like, no, I'm actually literally that as well.
This is because that's what you have to do, and you have to make money, and you went to school for theater, so...
Did you go to school for theater?
Yes, I
my
did.
My God.
I know. I've made some choices, Tynan.
You're doing fine, Sable. I'm in your two-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
Please.
I have been fortunate. Things have worked out well for me.
Yeah, but, you're fucking smart.
Yeah.
And then there's me.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I'm very smart.
Co-host of this podcast.
Co-host of the co-ghost.
Co-ghost.
Oh, I get it. Like, okay.
Co-ghost.
Woo.
I love it.
All right.
Anyway, back to G water.
Back to G water.
Sorry, Byredo, but we just co-opted that. But yes, this fragrance, it's very elegant in a not uptight way. It's like laid back eleganza, if you can put it that way. It smells to me, it's just like cozy sweaters. Just, I don't know. It's like being arm in arm with your boo, walking down the cobblestone streets of Soho.
Taylor Swift vibes.
Yes, very Taylor Swift, Cornelia Street vibes.
Yep. Stream folklore.
And I kind of shied away from it because of that. Because to me, it was like Nouveau Basic.
Mm.
But then I was like, wait, this is actually really nice.
Yeah.
And no one's complimented me on it, but I smell myself and I'm like, that's nice.
If no one compliments me on anything, it just goes in the trash.
Same.
Never again.
No, same, same. But then, like I'm also not interacting with as many people these days. So I just own the little travel size vial. So I've been slowly kind of nursing that throughout. God, I think I got that like 2 years ago at like a holiday set, but it's nice.
Also, what is perfume shopping right now like? Like, is that happening? Yeah. Can we do that? Because that involves like
people
touching
are doing
things.
It.
I went to Sephora.
Oh, yeah. What was that like?
It was fine. And you know how like everyone is saying that like there are no testers anymore. But I mean, that's a lie. Oh. I think they're telling you to like not test. And also like at...
Then why have them?
I know.
That's weird.
Because we're being told at work that like the same thing, like there's no testers anymore. You have to be, we have to use visual merchandising in a completely new and different way and really show everything you possibly can. But then I went to Sephora and there's testers out of makeup and really and fragrance and shit. Yeah, I don't know. It was very
weird. Sephora, explain yourself.
Anyway, what I meant was I want to go shopping.
Same.
Because I want to go to Burrito.
Are they open? Diaz and Durga just opened, reopened. I wonder if Burrito opened.
Probably.
I wonder if they ever shut down. Who knows? No. There's never anyone in there. So I'm
That's
like,
true.
They're like one person allowed at a time. Oh, it's normal.
Right, right. Exactly.
I've been to Manhattan literally like 4 times in the past 6 months. Mm-hmm. So maybe the next time I'm in that neighborhood, I'll just stroll along.
We should go.
Yeah, we should. What is it? Wooster Street?
I have no idea.
I think. Or Green Street. I know where it is by like my feet will just take me there.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah. What were we talking about? Back to the subject of our episode.
The smell of death.
We have an amazing guest who I literally found by Googling the smell of death, Mo Castandi, who is a neuroscientist or neurobiologist. So Mo Castandi, he wrote, it was on the first page of Google, he wrote a couple articles about what happens to your body after you die, the decomposition process, and the smell of death and what makes it up, how it's analyzed and all of that. So I was like, tell me all of this again in podcast form, please.
They were both articles are super interesting. The smell of, and the titles are bangers too.
Yeah.
And just literal, and one was The Smell of Death.
Yep.
And that was a more abbreviated article. Mm-hmm. And then wasn't it What Happens After You Die or something?
Something like that, yeah.
And I was like, ooh, spooky.
Yeah.
But then it was like, no, this is like how things decompose.
Yes.
But that was still, a lot of it was honestly like a little over my head, but it was still really interesting.
It was so fascinating. And it opened my eyes to a lot of like, I obviously was like, I don't know what happens after you die because I don't know anyone personally who's died. And if I did, they would be handled by
you.
Me.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not touching that. But the articles were so well written and easy to understand for someone like me, a plebe who studied theater and not science.
Yeah.
And it just made me want to learn more.
It's so funny, too, because our culture does not talk about death.
Yes.
You know what I mean? At all. No one knows. I don't mean to say, you know, no one knows what happens after you die, because obviously, but you know, no one knows what to do with the body.
Yeah.
And you know, no one knows how to handle anything. And other cultures are, you know, death is, I don't want to say celebrated, but like kind of, and
they're
it's
rituals,
ritualistic.
Though, yeah.
And yeah, there's a whole, like, you know, everyone knows it's very like based in the family and like, this is what this person does. And it's not us.
Yeah. Even grief. Like we don't as a culture, like even really touch on grief.
No.
It's just like very impolite. So no one talks about it.
Yeah. And shameful.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there's like a strange kind of shame. Like you have to like keep a stiff upper lip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you feel about death?
I okay.
I can't ask you. You are so much less tightly wound than I am. This is why I'm so glad that we are like both doing tightly wound than I am.
You know what, though? Actually, from a scientific standpoint, I was like, well, it's almost like if you're knocked unconscious, you just black out and then you just don't exist and you have no consciousness. So you don't care about it because you can't think about anything.
Me
so
from 19 to 26.
Yeah. So who cares? Like, because you're dead, you know?
Yeah.
And then I met two people who both of which had accidents. One was a car crash and one was an overdose. And they were pronounced dead for a handful of minutes, like in the hospital when they were trying to be resuscitated. And they both said very different stories, and they're like, no, there's a lot of shit beyond death. Like, I thought I was in a coma for 6 weeks and then I like came back and they were like, you were dead for 8 minutes, which also seems like a very long time.
Also, where did you meet these people?
Okay,
and were they together?
They were not together. One of them was a man I met on the subway.
You have awesome subway stories.
Yeah.
Oh, was that dude?
It was that dude, yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay.
You know, he, yeah. Anyway, I met a dude on the subway. It seemed promising at first. Didn't go anywhere. But he had a very fascinating story about getting hit by a car while biking home drunk and dying for a little while. Which, like, he said happened when we met. He said it happened 5 years prior. But he just, like, always talked about it. And part of me was like, I think you need to work through this trauma. Because, like, this is very on your mind and it happened 5 years ago.
No, that's just a straight guy thing. It's the only thing that's
might also
cool,
be that.
You know, only cool thing that's ever happened to him.
Yeah. And then part of me is like, is that your thing? like with girls, like you tell them how you died because it 100% worked. like I fucking fell for it. Yeah. So good on you, dude.
Right.
But yeah, that was fascinating. And the second other person was a Reiki instructor who said that he was
like... That's like healing, right? Sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Still not 100% on what Reiki is, but I know it involves healing in a spiritual way. And he said that he, before he was a Reiki instructor, he had like severe addiction problems and just like wasn't doing anything with his life. He OD'd. And then when he died for however many minutes before he was resuscitated, he's like, yeah, I was in this weird, like almost like an airport terminal. And what? Like all these other souls were waiting to reincarnate.
What?
And they could choose where they
Stop.
Went.
Stop.
Yeah, they could choose. And he's like, no one told me this. I just knew it at the time, like for whatever reason, intrinsically knew it, that I was told I could return to my body different than I was. They're like, what? They're like, well, you'd like, oh, you just died. So you're still fresh. So you can go back to that or you can go to someone new. Like you choose.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I'm like, I think there's some shit after death, man. I don't know about Christianity, but like.
I mean, Christianity is not the only option.
Yeah. And I just think. You know, it's like the concept of souls. Like, do you believe people have souls? And if you do, like, how could a soul just die once your body is no longer living?
That's so crazy.
It's so wild.
I'm horrified of death.
I'm horrified of it hurting or like suffering. Like, I know everyone dies, but I'm like, I just don't want to suffer.
I'm not about it. It's not in my plans.
It's not in my plans. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not aligned with it.
I'm going to skip that.
I feel like I'm always 3 seconds away from like getting bludgeoned or hit by a bus. You know what I mean? Just something like there's always like a Indiana Jones cannonball just like careening toward me.
Oh my God.
Like everything, every time I turn around. And that's not me saying like I'm afraid of death. I'm just like, I really don't want to be hit by a car ever in my life. Let's edit that out. But anyway, our interview, which is very fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And because it's not, you know, like we said, a topic that any of us really know how to approach. Mm-hmm. And there are in approaching it this way, it is so different than how we usually, you know, we usually think about death in that way. Like, what's after death? What happens? You know, what's next? But this is like, no, this is what happens when everything else is still here, but your soul or whatever is not.
Yeah.
Crazy.
When you're just a husk returning to the earth from whence you came. Anyway,
cool.
After that whole preamble,
I loved it.
Let's get to our episode with Mocha Standy. Let's do it.
Hello.
Hi, Mo.
Hello.
How's it going?
I was just, it occurred to me, maybe you should change your names to Pong and Stinks for this episode.
I like that.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your evening. Thank you for humoring me with this probably like very macabre podcast.
Well, that's excellent. I'm happy to be on your podcast.
Great. So what would your title be?
Well, a writer, really. I trained as a neuroscientist, the developmental neuroscientist. I work as a freelance writer and I write mostly about neuroscience. So that article was very out of my usual range of subjects, but it's actually the most popular thing I've ever written.
Wow.
It truly came up the first page on when I Googled it. It was one of the first articles that came up.
Yeah, you know, it's a quite comprehensive article about that. I don't think I've ever seen any of popular articles about the subject, not ones that go into that much detail.
I did not find any others either. So you mentioned that you work on, is it called a corpse farm?
A body farm.
A body farm. Okay.
So I visited 2 body farms in Texas as part of the research for that article.
Mm-hmm. There's more than one.
The first one to open was in Knoxville, Tennessee. That opened in about 1980. I visited 2 in Texas. The largest one is in San Marcos, and there's another one in Huntsville, Texas. Wow. And I think there may be 1 or 2 others elsewhere in the States. So I don't know where. And I know one opened in Australia a year or two ago. But there aren't many of these. They're forensic anthropology facilities, and people actually donate their bodies and the researchers leave them lying around in a field, basically.
Oh my God.
Wow.
You know, maybe submerged in water or in cages so that, you know, the vultures don't get to them, and they put all kinds of meteorological apparatus around the place so they can record all the atmospheric conditions to learn more about the process. I think some donors actually request that their bodies be left to the vultures, and that is of course something that one aspect of the process that researchers are also interested in. So some are deliberately left out for the vultures as well.
I mean, I guess they've got to study every possible scenario, so that makes sense. But why, it's just sounds so gnarly.
That sounds so scary. It sounds like a horror movie.
It does.
It was an extraordinary experience. I'd known about these places for some time, and I had prepared myself, and the only thing I was really concerned about was how I would react to the smell. But because it was midwinter, I actually couldn't smell very much at all. Not from the cadavers that I saw on the fields,
right,
at the rooms where they do their experiments. You know, they the embalming room, for example, in the morticians.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it has this constant sort of faint whiff of death all the time. Yeah.
Had you ever smelled death prior to this experience? But that was your first experience with the scent?
Yeah, I think it was. I don't recall ever seeing or smelling anything before that.
And did you like innately know that was what that smell was? Because I've personally never smelled death. So I wonder if that's the type of scent that humans would innately, instinctually understand as death.
Right.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if there's any understanding necessarily involved. I think we're repulsed by it, and we'll withdraw from it even if we've never encountered it
right
before, and that is an instinctive reaction, and almost all animals are repulsed by rotting things. Evolutionarily, that makes sense
because
they can be poisonous and transmit infectious diseases. So I think if you smell it, you may not immediately know exactly what it is. You might say, oh, it smells like someone's died, maybe.
Right.
But your immediate response, I think, would be to pull away from it.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think the closest comparison to that stench would be?
Well, rotting meat. Oh. That's not really a comparison. Actually,
it's literal.
We're made of meat, and actually people who have eaten human flesh say that it tastes like pork. So yeah, rotting meat, and that's not a comparison. That is actually
that's what it is,
what it is.
Yeah.
Oh, can we go back to the eating people? I have never. Where did you come across that in you know, your research? Or I'm just really interested in that, because that does, I mean, taste and smell do go hand in hand.
Yeah,
they do. And actually, you know, if you can't smell anything, you completely lose your sense of taste. Mm-hmm. As you know, if you've got a cold, you can't taste anything.
Right.
I don't remember where I read that human flesh tastes like pork. I mean, I am very interested in cannibalism. I've written a few things about it. For example, you know, there's a story about a human form of mad cow disease called Kuru, which is apparently transmitted by ritual mortualistic cannibalism among the Foray peoples in Papua New Guinea, but that's another story altogether. But there are examples of, I think there's a film called Alive, and this is actually a true story about the rugby team or something like that, and they were flying over the Andes and their plane crashed in, you know, on the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere.
I remember hearing that story, the news story rather, not the movie. I haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, and some of them resorted to cannibalism.
Oh my God.
To stay alive. So there are various accounts of cannibalism in sort of non-ritualistic contexts. So that may have been where I read this, where I read that human flesh tastes like pork. I haven't tried it myself.
I mean, you gotta eat.
Me neither.
I did used to bite my nails. I think that quite counts.
That makes sense.
It's seasoning.
Yeah, you know? It's in the same universe.
Yeah. So, can you explain a bit how is the smell of death studied exactly? Like, are there techniques or tools?
So, the smell is a complex mixture of gases formed by volatile organic compounds. So, one way that it can be studied is with a technique called gas chromatography, which is used to separate the components of a sample and measure how much of each is present. The way this works is you inject the sample into a stream of an inert carrier gas. So that's a chemically unreactive gas. Mm-hmm. Usually it's helium or nitrogen. And this transports the sample through a coiled column packed with silica or some other polymer. And this separates the components according to their affinity for the carrier gas. Those that bind to the carrier are quicker to reach a detector at the end of the column. And those that preferentially bind to the polymer move through the column more slowly. And the result is a graph with a series of peaks. And the position of a peak along the x-axis tells you how long that particular substance took to get through the column, and the height of the peak tells you the amount of that substance in the sample. So this is a common analytical chemistry technique. It has a lot of applications, such as, for example, testing for the presence of drugs in urine samples.
Okay.
Now, the bouquet of death contains hundreds of different gases. Many of them are very foul-smelling compounds. So it includes methane, hydrogen sulfide, and ammonia, which smell of farts, rotten eggs, and stale urine, respectively. There's dimethyl disulfide and trisulfide, which smell of garlic and rotting cabbage. There's indole, which smells of shit. There's 2-methylbutanoic acid, which smells of cheesy feet. Trimethylamine, which is the rotten fish smell, and butyric acid, which smells like vomit. It also contains phenol, which has a sweet burning rubber smell, and hexadecanoic acid, which is often described as the smell of old people's homes. But it also contains, it's quite a stench, but it also contains some gases with pleasant odors, such as hexane, which smells the freshly mown grass, and butanol, which smells of leaf litter and forest floors.
So earthy,
yeah,
kind of.
Yeah, well, I think it could be described as a very, very sickly and actually quite sweet smell.
So what are the chemical reactions or the microorganisms involved that are causing the odors?
So there's a process called putrefaction. And this is when the proteins, carbohydrates, and fatty acids and other substances that make up the internal organs and tissues are broken down by anaerobic bacteria. That's bacteria that can live without oxygen.
Okay.
And these bacteria, they also ferment the sugar molecules in the tissues, the carbohydrates, and that releases methane, hydrogen sulfide, and ammonia as byproducts. So many of these gases, rather, are produced as byproducts from the breakdown of the various substances that make up the tissues. Some of the compounds are present in the body or produced by the body. So two components of the smell of death are molecules called cadaverin and putrescine.
I love those names. Yeah, right? They sound so punk rock.
Yeah, it's a good name for a band.
Yeah, definitely.
So cadaverin is actually synthesized by all cells in living tissue. And there's a lot of cell death going on, even in living tissue. Cells are constantly dying and being replaced, and you get tissue damage as well, and damaged cells. If they're damaged beyond repair, then they'll be, you know, removed and replaced. So damaged and dying cells release cadaverin, and this molecule attracts immune system cells to the area that's damaged and gobble up the waste materials and dead cells.
Right.
It's a weird illustration of how the body is its own ecosystem, even after you die, in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because I was... and if I'm wrong, please let me know, because I probably am. But I was fascinated by, in your article, how you said, you know, even after, you know, whatever happens when you die, your body then knows what to do to start decomposing itself. I don't know. That was just really fascinating to me, that the process that started after, you know, everything else stopped.
I sort of started thinking about the process of decomposition in terms of thermodynamics. A body is just basically a lump of energy wrapped up as matter, locked in a particular configuration. And you can sort of think of life as a fight against entropy. Entropy is, you know, disorder, you know, and the second law of thermodynamics states that entropy in the universe always increases. That just means things fall apart, basically. So you know, when we're alive, there's something holding all our atoms together in a specific configuration, and when we die, that you know, you could think of decomposition almost as a process of, it's just a process of entropy. The organization of the atoms and molecules in our bodies just simply breaks down, and all of the energy in our bodies is released, and the matter is recycled.
It's like a biological unraveling. That's kind of cool.
That is cool.
So once a deceased body is decomposing and, you know, fumigating all of these crazy scents, what other organisms does that scent invite, and for what purpose?
Well, so most living things are repelled by this smell, but certain species are attracted to it. So there are insect species that will colonize cadavers to feed on the dead tissue and lay their eggs in it. And then when the eggs hatch, the maggots will also feed on the flesh. Then they'll mature into flies, fly away. They maybe come back later and lay their own eggs. So these species are attracted to cadaverin. So all species have olfactory receptors that detect smell molecules. in the air for most species. So the cadaverin receptor was isolated in identified in zebrafish about 7 years ago, and by some researchers in Germany working with others at Harvard, I think. But these researchers showed that when the zebrafish detects cadaverin through its receptor, that triggers an avoidance response. But these insects would have very, very similar receptors. You know, the receptors are very similar throughout the animal kingdom, but in these insects it would trigger an attractive rather than an avoidance response. So they will home in on the source of the smell. So the smell acts as a cue for them to find food, and there's a place for them to lay their eggs. Vultures, of course, they're another notable exception. They feed on rotting flesh, and they surely also have receptors for cadaverin and related molecules, and can use their sense of smell to find food. And they can feed on rotting flesh for various they've evolved various adaptations that enable them to do that. So their stomachs have a very high acid content, which can kill disease-causing bacteria. And their guts also contain bacteria that are related to the pathogenic bacteria that might be found in rotting meat, and that might confer tolerance or immunity.
Got it.
To anything that might be present in the rotting flesh.
Forgive me if this is obvious, but I find it so interesting that the death of one thing can breed new life in like another organism, like flies or maggots or what have you. It's just like a weird circle of life moment, but yeah, it's also equally as gross. I don't know. to me.
Well, even a body that's embalmed and buried in a coffin, but even then, you know, embalming just slows down the process of decomposition. Even embalmed bodies will eventually decompose, and unless they've been buried in a sort of airtight titanium coffin, which you can be buried in if you want,
if you can afford it.
If you can afford it, yeah. But otherwise the body will eventually decompose, and the liquefied tissues, or at least some of them, will leak out into the surroundings, and that actually enriches the soil. It increases the biodiversity in the surrounding area, so you get an increase in the number of plant species and the numbers of nematode worms and that kind of thing in a small area surrounding the body.
That's really interesting, and I wonder if maybe any sort of research at the body farms, maybe, like, do you think they are thinking of figuring out a way how to use those substances to help proliferate growth and greater biodiversity in other areas?
Oh, that's an interesting possibility. I'm not sure about that. I do know that some body farm researchers think that this might provide a new way of searching for, you know, murder victims to have been buried in a shallow grave or something like that, because there's this release of energy into the soil that actually changes the thermal spectrum of the area or something like that, which is actually observable by thermal imaging. You know, if the police are out searching for a body, shall we say, you know, they'll have a team sort of spreading out and walking across a bit of land. But another way of doing that might be to send up a drone with a thermal imaging camera to look for energy hotspots, you know, small patches of land that look slightly different from the surrounding areas. And that might be one way of finding murder victims. I don't know if anyone's thinking of using you're basically using bodies as compost. I don't know, but that's an intriguing possibility, I think.
I remember reading about a service where when you die, instead of being buried in a traditional way in a coffin, in a casket that's very expensive, you could basically turn yourself into a tree where you get buried in, like, it's like a little tree pod that has either a sapling or a seed. And then your decomposition helps to feed this growing tree as like a memorial.
Oh, crazy.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, so some of the material from your body would be incorporated into the tree.
Yeah.
If you're buried directly under it.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of that, but I have heard of a service. I think was it they take your ashes, which are carbon, right? So if a loved one is cremated, you can send their ashes to these companies that will use them to make synthetic gemstones. So you can have a synthetic diamond.
And
diamonds are diamonds are pure carbon, right? Carbon atoms locked in a tetrahedral pattern. There are companies that will make synthetic diamonds out of people's ashes.
That's sick. You can be a tree, I'll be a haunted piece of jewelry.
Actually, we know somebody who did that, Renee Rouleau, when her husband passed away.
Oh my God.
She turned him into a diamond.
That's sick.
Yeah. So yeah, when you were talking about that, I was like, wait, this sounds familiar. And then I was like, yes, I remember you can turn, because ashes are carbon, you're right. Wow.
It's a beautiful, it's quite beautiful, I think. You know,
it
so
is, yeah.
The first law of thermodynamics is that, you know, the amount of energy in the universe never changes. Energy can't be created or destroyed.
Right.
It can only be transformed from one form to another. So another way of thinking about that is that all the matter in the universe has always existed. And as long as the universe exists, all the matter will always exist. So all the atoms that make up our bodies, you know, they were born in deep space. All the atoms in the universe have always existed and will always exist. They just change their configurations. So
I like that. So everyone really is eternal.
Yeah.
It's a nice thought.
And made of stardust.
Yeah.
It's not ready for any of this, but I love
it. I know. I was like, I was not prepared for such an existential conversation, but I'm happy it's happening. So how do you think that a body's decomposition scent can help us in understanding the nature of death? Like, how do they use that information to, for instance, solve a crime or determine a cause of death?
Well, at the moment, we don't really know enough about it, but it could have a number of uses in forensics. So we know that the smell changes over time.
Right.
You know, so a better understanding of how its composition changes with time could, for example, help to determine the time of death. And if you can determine, we could call them the signature notes of the odor, that would be helpful in training dogs to find corpses. But because the smell changes with time as the process of decomposition progresses,
mm-hmm.
they still haven't figured out exactly which components of the smell would be best for training these cadaver dogs.
These cadaver canines.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating, especially now with all the innovations in forensics. I feel like that's probably coming down the line.
Yeah,
I can't see how it couldn't.
It could also have other applications, though, completely outside of psychiatry. So something I found out today, actually, which I thought was fascinating, is that one variant of the human cadaverin receptor plays a role in how people respond to antidepressants.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And yeah, another variant has been linked to the higher risk of suicide. Now, that's just a correlation. You know, it's a correlation, not a causation.
Right, but right. Got it.
It may at some point be possible with this knowledge to develop a death smell test that could help to identify individuals who are at risk of psychiatric conditions.
Wow.
And this is like a new discovery, because you just found out about it today.
Well, yeah, the studies that I found are quite recent. They're not brand new, but I think a couple of years old.
Got it. I'm always fascinated when I hear about how two seemingly totally unrelated things have this sort of correlation, and like how people discover that.
Mm. Well, there's a lot of serendipity in scientific discovery.
So do you think that the corpse smell, as it were, does it ever go away? I mean, I guess eventually it does go away on its own, but how long do you reckon that would take? I mean, it would clearly be different in a field as opposed to like in a residence or building.
Yeah. Well, that really depends on a lot of things. Say we've got a rotting corpse. The smell is strongest at the early and middle stages of decomposition, when this putrefaction is taking place. So the proteins and carbohydrates are breaking down, and these gaseous byproducts are building up within the corpse, and that actually causes bloating, and the skin will eventually rupture at its weakest points, and the body will pop, as morticians say. And the liquefied tissue will begin to leak out, and the gases will escape more easily. So up to this stage, the smell can be very, very strong. Afterwards, the remains will begin to dry out and skeletonize, after which the smell won't be so strong.
Right.
The rate of decomposition depends on many factors, but the main one is temperature. So the higher the temperature, the faster the rate of decomposition. If it's very hot, these processes will take place quickly, and the corpse will, I suppose, give off a stench for, say, up to a week before it begins to dry up. But if it's in an enclosed space, the smell will permeate everything. It lingers in the air, it lingers in the furniture and clothes. It lingers in your nostrils for a day or two. So when you've got what's called an unattended death, you know, someone dies at home and their body isn't discovered for...
It's one of my fears.
Yeah, days or weeks or even months, then that, you know, that will smell really, really bad. But there are what are called death cleanup services who remove the remains after an unattended death and clean up afterwards. They have various methods of deodorizing, but you know that there's no big secret. You know, they'll rip up the carpets and use industrial enzymatic cleaning products, air purifiers, and that kind of thing. Now, I don't know if they can remove the smell completely. I suppose that would depend on the exact circumstances of the death. There's a recent book actually all about that called The Trauma Cleaner.
Wow.
And
what a title.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's by Sarah Krasnostein, okay. The Trauma Cleaner. Mm. That's all about.
I'm going to look that up.
It's about someone who went into that line of work, you know, cleaning up mm-hmm. unattended deaths and murder victims and that kind of thing.
Wow.
I remember reading a book a couple of years ago by a forensic scientist, and her job, she worked in New York City, and her job was to basically investigate all the dead bodies found in New York City to determine the cause of death and the time. And in the instances of unattended deaths, when often, because like New York City, it's all apartment buildings, it would be the neighbors who would call the authorities to investigate. And then they would tell the building, they would tell everybody to brew coffee at the same time.
What?
And that the smell of coffee would either neutralize, like it wouldn't get rid of the scent, but it would neutralize it from your ability to pick it up.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. There's a process called lateral inhibition in the nervous system, you know, where, you see, that's why... Rubbing around an injury alleviates the pain some bit, because the activity in the nerve fibers sort of interferes. The activity in adjacent nerve fibers interfere with each other. So maybe that's why the smell of coffee might sort of compete,
yeah,
you know, in the nose. Probably not for the same receptor, but for the flow of information from the nose to the brain.
Yeah, like I don't think it's actually doing anything for the actual whatever stench is there, but I think for the neighbors it just makes it more bearable.
Yeah, it's sort of distracting.
Yeah. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I'm so glad we got a hold of you.
Yeah.
And thank you again for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've enjoyed it too.
Great.
So thank you. Thanks for inviting me on.
Of course, yeah. Okay, wow.
I know.
That was a lot.
That was a lot of a lot. And, you know, like the articles, a bit of it was over my head. But I think that's okay.
That's
you know,
fine.
Science is not my bag, clearly. But
I love how he went into like, the existentialism beyond death. Like, that was nice.
That was, I think, what was missing for me from parts of it. And then we circled back to it and I was like, ah, okay.
I like that.
I mean, obviously I can't have a thought without an emotion accompanying it. So like, this is a, you know, illustration of that. But yeah, wow.
Perhaps we should have put a disclaimer for the squeamish up front. So
surprise, bitch.
Surprise, it's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what happens when you die.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's like... Like I kind of said, even when you die, like things keep going.
I know. I like the idea where it's like everyone who's existed, they're still around in just a transformed kind of energy.
I know. That always blows my mind how we are all made of stardust. Yeah. I know that sounds like very Pinterest, but...
I'm pretty sure I've seen some Pinterest that say exactly that.
Yeah.
But now that a scientist said it, I'm more amenable to it.
Yeah, exactly. Now I can put it on my walls.
Yes.
Wow.
Well... I hope you guys enjoyed that.
Yeah,
and
same.
Okay, this is why I didn't initially want to call us a perfume podcast, because this is among the things that we wish to explore with Smelly Later.
Yeah, for sure.
Not just fine fragrances, not just candles or home fragrances, but also crazy smells like the smell of death.
You know what I was thinking this week? I want to do a smell of love for Valentine's Day. I know we already kind of have a Valentine's Day episode planned, but we can think about it.
We can do multiple ones.
Hell yeah.
We don't have bosses.
Exactly.
Who's gonna tell us no?
I know. I love being the boss. But yeah, if you guys have any ideas that you would love to see us explore, hit us in the DMs.
DM us.
Also, please tell us what you're gonna be for Halloween, or share your best or favorite costume. We are obsessed with Halloween.
Yes.
I know it's like not related to the podcast, but I don't care.
It is now.
It's a Halloween podcast this week.
Yep.
Yeah. So follow us on Instagram, smellylater.mp3. Follow me at TynanBuck.
And follow me at SableToothTigre.
If you are going out this weekend, please be safe.
Wear a mask.
It can be a scary mask.
Yeah. Wear a mask underneath your mask.
Please remember that we are still very much in a pandemic.
Yeah.
And tensions are high.
I hope people are really creative with like incorporating their pandemic masks into their costumes.
Yes.
Like that would be cool.
Do not drink and drive.
Don't fucking do it.
You know, don't even drink and walk.
Don't drink. Don't walk.
Sable, don't drink.
Don't drink. Just kidding. Don't listen to me.
So yes.
Leave us...
five
some
stars.
Nice, yes. Leave us some nice stars, some stardust on Apple Podcasts if you like. And yeah, that's this week's episode. Smell you later.
Smell you later.